We leap forward in our gospel reading today. Last week, Jesus was talking about terrible events to come. And this week, a terrible event is being enacted, the very crucifixion of Jesus. When they came to the place that is called the skull, they crucified Jesus there with the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. And the text draws us on from here to greater things, but it's helpful to first understand crucifixion in the context of Jesus' community and Luke's community. In any age, the plain physical and emotional horror of this kind of execution is clear. The extended suffering and exposure to the elements seem cruel and draw to mind a lament of meaninglessness. But to this community, crucifixion had a very clear meaning. For them, perhaps even more than being about pain, crucifixion was a process that was a calculated act of the state, aimed at tearing down the social standing of an undesired leader. The people of first century Palestine were wholly immersed in a social structure of relationships of honor and shame. At birth, a person was ascribed their starting place in the hierarchy based upon their family, and they basically spent the rest of their life just trying to hang on to that position. The honor of a person was determined always relative to the other members of their community, and for the honor of one person to rise, the honor of someone else had to fall accordingly. To gain honor required a public challenge. This is risky. And any gains and losses and honors would be seen by the whole community and be carried forward. This setting forms the backdrop of the continual challenges that we see Jesus in throughout the Gospels. Whether he's arguing with the Pharisees about taxes, or with the Sadducees about resurrection and marriage, or arguing with the scribes, Jesus has consistently been rising in honor and undermining the authorities. And within this hierarchy of honor sits the system of patronage, whereby a leader commands loyalty based on the favors that they can give out to those below them. Seen in this light, Jesus is especially respected for his healing, for his interpretation of the scriptures, and audaciously, for his ability to forgive sins. In this role, Jesus offers that through his intercession, God becomes our patron. Crucifixion is the systematic, progressive, public tearing down of this teacher Jesus. With the beatings and the floggings go the honor of the Sermon on the Mount. And as Jesus carries the crossbar of his own execution device, gone is the honor of the feeding of the 5,000. And with the gross degeneration of his own body during the crucifixion itself goes the honor of every sickness healed, of every demon cast out, and even of a little girl raised from the dead. The political and religious rulers have ensured that by this moment, any Roman or Jew under Roman occupation should be quite clear that this man has not a shred of the honor required to be a ruler or to hold the patronage of even a single person. And in a stark, mocking gesture, they inscribe the sign proclaiming his crime, "This is the King of the Jews." A great and cruel joke, they believe. And yet, 2,000 years later, we sit together celebrating Christ the King Sunday. The Feast of Christ the King was proclaimed a feast in the church In 1925, it was begun by our Roman Catholic brothers and sisters and adopted by the Anglicans and Lutherans and Methodists and Christians the world over in the years ahead of that. It recognizes Jesus as the ruler of a kingdom which stands apart from the nations of this world. Against a perceived backdrop of conflict-ridden nationalism and expanding secularism, the Church has affirmed an alternative teaching on authority. As Jeremiah boldly prophesies this morning, "Woe to the shepherds who destroy and scatter the sheep of my pasture, says the Lord. Whereas the kings of this world have led poorly, God intends to raise up a righteous shepherd who will reign as king and deal wisely." In Luke's genealogy, earlier in the same gospel we heard from this morning, he makes very clear that we understand that Jesus is the fulfillment of this promise. Here is a shepherd who will be good for us, who will execute justice and save God's people. But what kind of shepherd dies painfully while the people look on? How can this possibly be seen as good for the sheep? Jesus hangs upon the cross in the midst of a cacophony of voices and perspectives. The people, so recently cheering him into the city, stand mutely. The leaders, reveling in their own power, scoff. The opportunists, greedy for the clothes of a naked man, cast lots. And the soldiers, supporting and affirming the power of a corrupt state, mock. And finally, even the criminal to Jesus' side derides. The criminal's words bring together the pain and the anger and maybe even a sliver of hope that's swirling around in this moment. "Are you not the Messiah? Save yourself and us. Use your power to change this. How is this good for me? How is this good for us?" As our brothers and sisters in the Philippines bury thousands of their neighbors, how can we do more than stand by mutely? As holders, perhaps, of our own retirement investments or stewards of church money, what can we do to be sure that we're doing more than casting lots against our national and global neighbors? As citizens of a powerful nation, populated 98% by immigrants and the children of immigrants, how can we ensure that our voice and our vote do more than add more mocking to the conversation about immigration? What moment or issue of turmoil hangs in each of our lives today? And what is our posture as we look to and address our shepherd Jesus? This past summer, as a hospital chaplain, I was invited into the room of a young man with Crohn's disease. I'll call him Alan out of respect for his privacy. Crohn's disease results from the body's immune system attacking its own gastrointestinal tract from top to bottom. The true cause is unknown, and the symptoms are unpredictable and can incapacitate the sufferer through physical pain, inability to absorb nutrients, and the resulting weakness that comes from that. And there's no known cure. After years since his last flare-up, Alan was in the hospital for the fourth time in 4 months. He changed his entire diet. He was sleeping more. He'd cut high-stress activities out of his life. He followed all the best practices, but still his body fought itself. He found, but before his recent flares, he had shared this personal trial with very few people. He found that when he did share, people were unsure how to react to his suffering, becoming tentative and overly cautious in their relationships with him. But his necessary recent absences from work had forced him to share this with his employer. This was particularly worrying him as he was concerned about his job security at the job he loved. And to his friends, the real meaning and impact of Crohn's disease in his life continued to remain all but unknown. He worried that their invitations would slowly fade out of their fear and confusion about the turmoil in his life. And his parents, unfortunately, lived too far away to do more than offer love from a distance. As I listened and wondered at Alan's story and the cacophony of perspectives around him, I found I was nearly speechless. What was the faithful path forward? And then he said, "But my wife and mother-in-law are really a great support." He did worry about how they would be affected by his need for increasing care, but he also knew they would stand by him and could listen. "My mother-in-law thinks that I should meditate and give more away to people and to charity," Alan said. And as we continued to talk about his family and his spiritual response, a stillness settled upon us. A stillness in which we were drawn into meditation ourselves. A stillness which offered a perspective from outside of the whirlwind. Our bodies, his in physical pain, and mine very aware of what was happening to him, relaxed. And our spirits glimpsed some greater authority beyond suffering. "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." In the midst of mockery and drowning shouts of derision and a cacophony of fearful perspectives, the criminal to Jesus' other side speaks out. "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And if his words were not spoken above a whisper, I believe that they must have sounded like the song of angels in Jesus' ears. "Jesus, I see your broken body, and I am experiencing for myself the shame that they would put upon you. But I see that your kingship is undiminished. By the rules of this nation and this world, I am receiving death, but I yearn to be under your authority and to receive life. Your flock remains. I will be honored in your patronage." And if there was ever a worker, as in Jesus' parable, who is hired an hour before closing time and paid the full day's wages nonetheless, this is that worker. With humble desire for the kingdom of forgiveness and trust in a kingdom beyond suffering, the second criminal, the listener, steps into new life. What is your place of stillness, and who are the people that bring you that stillness so that you can ask with this listening criminal, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom"? "For truly I tell you," says the Shepherd King Jesus, "today you will be with me in paradise."